So first of all, many thanks to the organizers for admitting me to this conference. I came here to really to learn, but given a chance to speak, I thought I'd tell you about this work, which is, I think, somewhat fits into the topic here, into the general topic. I think in view of Raphael's earlier talk, I should make a qualification here. I'm going to talk only about the perturbative path integral for any modular gravity. So I won't address the conceptual issues that you discussed and you addressed, but just compute one-loop determinants and path integral for unimodular gravity. So unimodular gravity is gravity where you just constrain the metric to have determinant one. That's why it's called unimodular. In general, actually, I'm going to require just that the determinant of G, somewhat more generally, is some prescribed function omega of x. You don't need to say that it's one, but if you want, there's no loss of generality in doing so. So this is sometimes presented as a constraint on the theory, but in fact, it's not much of a constraint in the sense that the square root of the determinant is a scalar density of weight one, so it transforms with a det dx dx prime. So there is given any g of x, you can always change coordinates and set this new g to be any function that you like. So you can see this more as a choice of gauge rather than a constraint on the theory. So having fixed the determinant, then you have essentially broken the group of diffeomorphisms to the subgroup of volume-preserving diffeomorphism, namely those which keep this volume form fixed. And this group I call the special diffeomorphisms. So this is a group of, mathematically speaking, one would call it volume-preserving diffeomorphisms. And I call it S-diff because the relation of S diff to diff is the same as the relation of SON to ON. It is a subgroup that preserves the volume. Or also a relation of SLN to GLN. So the algebra of this group of special diffeomorphisms consists of vector fields which are divergence free. So the variation, the infinitesimal variation of the metric, as you know, is under is this. The infinitesimal variation of the square root of the determinant is the square root of the determinant times d mu epsilon mu. So requiring that the variation of the determinant is zero fixes your infinitesimal parameters to be divergence-free. So the algebra of this group is the subalgebra of transverse vector fields. All right. So now, given any action for gravity, so typically I'm going to talk generically of GR. I'm going to call GR any theory of any metric theory of gravity. So a theory where the metric is a dynamical variable. I'm not necessarily Einstein-Hilbert action. So the action of GR for a metric is the integral dx square root g some Lagrangian. And the corresponding unimodular action, so an action for unimodular gravity, is just the same thing, where here you replace square root g by this fixed omega. So the variations of these actions are different, as you see, because here you have also to vary the volume element, and here you don't. The the equations that you get from here, suppose, for example, that this is R, the Einstein action, Hilbert action, then you get Einstein equation here with zero cosmological constant. When you vary this action, you get the trace-free part of the equations, because the variation of the infinitesimal variations now have to be trace-free. The equations at first look different, but then you can use differential identities and you can convert them back to the same form that you had as these equations had. So you see, since I told you that the square root of g is just a gauging, can be brought to any form by a gauge transformation, the information that is contained in the variation of square root g is pure gauge information. And so you can reconstruct that information by differential identity. So that's why the equations that you get from these two sets of actions are the same. But there is this critical subtlety that when you do reconstruct the Einstein equation in this way, you have a constant of integration that appears. And so even though there may not be a cosmological term in the action, the equations in principle contain an arbitrary cosmological constant term. And so this is why this theory has been interesting, because vacuum energy here does not enter in the equation of motion. You see, vacuum energy is just a constant time, and it's totally, this part of the action is totally independent of any dynamical variable. So the vacuum energy doesn't enter here. It doesn't affect the equations of motion. And so this offers some different perspective on the cosmological constant problem, and I'm not going to say much more about that. So the question that I want to address now, so at the canonical level, so the equations of motion are the same, then you can ask, does the theory have the same dynamical variable? So this has been addressed in a very nice paper by Eno and Teitelbaum in the 90s. So, roughly speaking, in generically in a gauge theory, you start from, you count all the fields that you have, and you subtract twice, in order to get the number of physical degrees of freedom, you subtract twice the number of gauge parameters. And if you did this for unimodular, for ordinary gravity, you get two. If you do it for ordinary gravity, you get two. If you did this for unimodular gravity, you would get three. It's the wrong answer. So you go to that paper, and there it's explained very nicely in canonical formalism. So in canonical formalism, let's do GR first. You start with, so you have 20 metric components, which means 10 metric components is 20 canonical variables. Then you have four primary constraints, four secondary constraints. These are all first class, and each of them removes two degrees of freedom. So when you do this, you remain here with four, which is four canonical variables for the two polarization states of a graviton. So in unimodular gravity, it works slightly differently. So you start with nine functions, because the metric has now only nine independent components. So you have here 18. And then the group is S diff, which has three parameters. So you have three primary constraints, three secondary constraints. And then the novelty here is that there's also a tertiary constraint. They're all first class. So when you do this, you get again four. Okay, so I have just summarized how this works. So given that the theories are equivalent at the classical level, the question is, are they equivalent at the quantum level? And this, there are some various claims in the literature in one way or other. So in order to address this question in a very concrete way, we decided to calculate the logarithmic divergences for the path integral of unimodular gravity. So in the case of gravity with cosmological constant. This had been computed by Christensen and Duff. So the effective action for gravity is classical action. So I'm going to introduce some operators here. So I'm going to call delta this operator on any field. I'm going to call delta zero on scalars. I'm going to call delta one on vectors. And I'm going to call delta two it's plus 1/6 R on symmetric tensors. So these are the operators that appear in these calculations. So this is the operator acting on spin 2. This is a determinant on the spin 2 degrees of freedom, and these are the ghosts. And then you can calculate what this is. And you get some numbers, which are the calculation is performed on an Einstein background, and so term Ricci, which is Ricci square, can be converted into R square. So these are the only two independent combinations. And so the question is, will we get the same result in unimodular gravity or not, basically? So Claudio said that physicists can be divided into those that know the answer beforehand and don't need to calculate, and then there are those that calculate. And then there's a third category, which is those that think that they know the answer beforehand, they calculate and they get a different answer. So this is so this was my case, I'm afraid. So the perturbative path integral is done by expanding the metric around some background and then integrating out the fluctuations. So I'm going to use a parametrization. Usually the metric is split additively. G is G bar plus H. I'm going to use a different parametrization. An exponential parametrization. So here, H is a symmetric, covariant symmetric tensor, and G bar minus one H is what you, is just the mixed components, okay? So, rho nu is G bar rho sigma H sigma nu. So I'm just exponentiating here the mixed components of this fluctuation.
So what kind of regularizations they use?
One
over epsilon zero.
There's one over epsilon, but yeah, so
it's, divergent part, right?
It's a logarithmically divergent part.
It's logarithmically divergent.
you can use dimensional regularization, and those numbers are just the B4 Seeley-DeWitt coefficients of those two operators combined. Okay. The original calculation was done by Toft and Weltmann in flat space, and they did it on a curved background with cosmological constants. All right, so it will appear in a moment why I prefer to do this. This is much better suited to unimodular gravity than the other decomposition.
Sorry, what is H?
H, where? Here? Mm-hmm. It's a fluctuation field. What you would normally interpret it as G bar mu nu plus H mu nu, that's the H.
Right.
But here it's exponentiated instead of being just added. All right, so now I'm going to, now you see, we want to set up a path integral. So it's going to be z of g bar, and I'm going to integrate out this fluctuation field.
So you want to do it for spin 2 or what?
Yeah, for the fluctuation, I'm going to integrate out h mu nu.
Right, but for instance, you wrote it. For scalar field, for vector and spin 2, I guess.
Yes, because
so
now
the
I'm.
Coefficients there are different, right?
Yeah, yeah. So.
So, this coefficient by 29 over what is spin 2?
That is the sum of those contributions from spin 2 and spin 1. There are two determinants.
It should depend on the number of fields of the object.
No, there's only one graviton, h mu nu.
No, I mean that if you would have also spinners, vectors.
Ah, yeah, yeah, then there would be additional contributions. This is pure gravity that I'm doing here.
It's pure gravity, but then you write vector, but actually there should be only tensor for pure gravity.
No, this will appear in a moment why I'm doing this. So the purpose of now, when you want to define this path integral, what you have to do, since this is a gauge theory, you have to factor out the volume of the gauge group. Normally, we do this simply by applying the Fedev-Popov recipe. However, you see, in this theory, there's a subtlety because the gauge parameter is subjected to a differential constraint. Epsilon is not a free; it's divergence free. And so in these circumstances, I'm really not so sure how to apply the Fedev-Popov procedure.
But you can do it because it's one book calculation.
Yeah.
Then you can factorize explicitly in the unitary gauge or in the physical gauge, this gauge of...
That's exactly what I'm going to do. That's exactly what I'm going to do. Yeah. So in order to factorize this volume of the gauge group, I'm going to use the method that Emil was advertising during his talk. So I start with the fluctuation, and I decompose it in various components. So there's a part that is transverse and trace-free. Then there's a vector part. Then there's a part like it looks like this. Sorry, minus one. We are in four dimensions. And there's a trace, always four. Okay, so this is transverse and trace free. Xi is trace free transverse vector. And then you have these two scalar components.
It's in four dimensions.
It's in four dimensions, yes.
But then you don't separate.
Well, now I'm going to show you how it happens. So I'm going to rewrite this integral over h as an integral over those h mu nu tt, d xi, d sigma, and dh. And then there's a Jacobian here. And this Jacobian, just you work it out, it's the determinant of delta 1. There's it acting on vectors. And there's two scalar determinants, det delta to the 1/2 and det delta 0 to the 1/2. Yeah?
Just to avoid my getting lost, since you argued at the classical level that the Marx-Miramaggio theory is a gauge fixing of the original theory, would you agree that there is some choice of measure for the Unimaggio path interval such that it's identical to the usual theory? And the issue is just whether you've imposed that choice of measure or a different choice of measure.
Well, as you'll see, the path integrals that you start with are slightly different.
So, but
the
because of a measure factor.
Yeah, essentially because of
measure. So, do you agree that you could correct that measure factor if you so desired to make them the same theory?
Yeah, that's what will happen. So now let's look at how each of these objects transforms under diffeomorphism. So we have this transformation. So delta H, so let's take a diffeomorphism, epsilon, infinitesimal diffeomorphism, and we decompose this into a transverse part and a longitudinal part. And then delta H mu nu, or delta G mu nu, is d mu epsilon nu plus d nu epsilon mu. So d mu epsilon nu transverse. And then there's 2 times d mu d nu of phi. And now let me here add and subtract the trace part. Right, and so now you can compare this line with this line, and so you read off how each of these components transforms under diffeomorphisms. So HTT is invariant, Xi transforms by a shift, Sigma transforms by a shift with Phi, and H also transforms by a shift with phi, but with a Laplacian operator in addition, which will play an important role in a moment. Oh, God.
Sorry.
Yeah, sure. So delta HTT is 0, and delta, and then there's another variable, S, which is H plus delta sigma, which is also invariant. So there's a combination of scalars that is invariant. So this decomposition neatly separates gauge invariant part, which is HTT and S, from gauge variant, from gauge variables, which are Xi, and then another combination of the two scalars. So the idea now is that, first of all, I'm going to I have to expand the action in order to do a calculation at one loop. So e to the minus s is e to the minus s classical. And then there's the second order fluctuation, which depends on g bar and h. All right, so now if I work out what this s2 is, it's an integral. And here I have 1/2 HTT delta 2. And then there's something like 3 over 16 S delta 0 S. So you see that only the gauge invariant fluctuations enter here. Now we can turn this integral d sigma dh into an integral d sigma ds without any further Jacobians. And so this integral h over HTT, this is a Gaussian integral. And the integral over S is another Gaussian integral. And then we have what remains is integral d xi d sigma, which are the gauge variables. So e to the minus S of g bar, integral dh d sigma. And then there's all these determinants. Well, let me write them again. So, and here now we have that delta 2 minus a half, and that delta 0 minus a half. So that delta 0 goes away. And now we have integral dh d sigma.
Shouldn't that be
d xi d sigma? D xi d sigma, yes. So you see, we can, since the xi and sigma transform under shift, we can identify a neighborhood of the identity in the gauge group with a neighborhood of the background field in the orbit in the space of metrics parameterized by epsilon t and phi. So these two integrals, d xi d sigma, becomes integral d epsilon t d phi. So this is the integral over the diffeomorphism group. And there's a Jacobian when you change variables from epsilon to epsilon t and phi, which is a determinant of a Laplacian. And so, and it is precisely this determinant that appears here, so that these three guys together are the volume of the diffeomorphism group. And what remains then is, you see, just a determinant of delta 2 to the minus a half and a determinant of delta 1 to a 1 half. When you take the logarithm, that's the effective action that is written up on the top line up there. Okay. So this is the calculation of Christensen and Duff. So what changes when you do unimodular gravity? The only difference, all right. So now we see why it is convenient to use this exponential parametrization, because if you assume that the background is unimodular, So the determinant then of G is the determinant of G bar times the determinant of this exponential. And if I take this object here in the exponential to be trace-free, then this exponential, the determinant is 1. So you see that by using that parametrization with H trace-free, I am automatically summing over unimodular metrics. So the partition function then for unimodular gravity is the same as that one, except that you don't have H, the trace part, from the beginning. So you have here exponential minus S of G bar dHTT d xi and d sigma. Then there's a Jacobian. Delta 0 to the 1 half. So what about the action now? So since we have now h is equal to 0, you see that in the unimodular gravity, S is just box of sigma. Yeah. And so here we have S is, there are two more boxes with sigma here. So now I do the integral of the Gaussian integral over sigma and over H, and I get the determinant of delta 2 to the minus a half, determinant of delta, you see you have delta 0 to the minus a half, and that delta to the minus 1 now. So I've done these. This keeps canceling, and these two together give me a determinant to the power minus a half. So let me write it like this now. And now we have here an integral over xi, which is the integral over the transverse vector fields, which should be the gauge group in this case. And if you just think that this is the volume of the gauge group, then you are led to believe that here you have determinant of delta 2, delta 1, but also an additional scalar determinant, which is wrong, because if that was the case, it would mean that this theory has a different number of degrees of freedom than GR, because this gives you 5 minus 3, and then there's plus 1. This would contradict this counting that I did over here, that I wrote over there. Okay, so that can't be. So the answer to this, since I'm already over time, is simply that, and I didn't suspect this really, came as a surprise, is that the volume of the group of special diffeomorphism is integral d xi divided the determinant of this delta. Yeah. Now, I wouldn't have guessed this, but the explanation is as follows. I can show you that. I can finally just tell you this. You can think of the space. Think of this quotient space of diff m divided by s diff m. So I told you that the group diff m acts transitively on volume forms, and s diff is the stabilizer of a particular volume form. So this quotient is the space of volume forms. And therefore, I can write the volume of S diff to be the volume of Q divided by the volume of diff divided by the volume of Q. Now, because of the volume of diff is integral over d epsilon, and the volume of Q is the integral of over H, because those are the infinitesimal variations of the volume form. So these integrals are honest to God quantities that are independent of the metric and you can throw away in the functional integral. But now if I use these, if I write them in terms of transverse and longitudinal parts, this becomes the delta to the 1/2, and this is just, so here I have to use this line. I identify, you see, H can be identified with phi up to that Laplacian. So integral dH is integral d phi times the determinant of the Laplacian in the denominator. So here you see that you get integral over epsilon t times that delta to the minus 1/2. And that's exactly what we need. So then in the end, this is the quantity that this thing in this potato here is the volume of the diffeomorphism group. You can throw that away. And what remains are the same two determinants that we had in GR. So that's the conclusion.